My guest is Todd Rundgren. He's a composer, musician, singer, and record producer, who's also a pioneer of synthesizer and studio production techniques. He's recorded with his bands, The Naz and Utopia, but many of Rundgren's albums have been solo outings, where with the help of multi-tracking, he plays most of the instruments and does all the voices. He's also produced albums for other performers, including Patti Smith, Grand Funk Railroad, Hall & Oates, The New York Dolls, and Meatloaf. Recently, Rundgren has branched out into TV and film work. He scored several installments of Pee-wee's Playhouse and is now working on the new series. He also did music for episodes of Crime Story. And Joseph Papp recently commissioned him to compose the music for a stage version of Up Against It, the screenplay Joe Orton wrote for the Beatles in 1967. We're going to talk about those new projects in a little while. First, we're going to talk about his recording style. And by the way, Rhino Records is reissuing on CD all of his albums that were on his Beersville record label. This recording that we're about to hear will give you an idea of why Todd Rundgren has been called the Wizard. All the voices on this record are Todd Rundgren's voice, and even the sounds of the instrument are his voice put through a synthesizer. From his album A Cappella, this is his song, Something to Fall Back On. Todd Rundgren, who's joining us now from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Todd. How are you?
Fine. And how are you?
Yeah. It's amazing you did all the voices on that. You were really one of the first people to use state-of-the-art studio production to do all your own work on a record. And I wonder why you wanted to head in that direction.
It was kind of a sideline to my production. When I first started, when I left the NAS, I didn't really intend to make records of my own. I wanted to produce other people's records. And at a certain point, I got a little itchy to experiment in the studio, and that was kind of the accidental beginning of my solo career. I put together a record and only expecting it would be kind of a sideline. And fortunately or unfortunately, there was a hit single on it, so I wound up having to repeat the act many times over.
Is it enjoyable, or at least does it give you a feeling of control to do it all yourself? It seems to me it would give you the opportunity of totally acting out your vision. You don't have to worry about whether someone plays the line you wanted to hear. I mean, you're doing it all yourself.
In a certain sense, it's mostly to accommodate the kind of creative, the kind of way that I write songs. I usually work in the studio, and it's more difficult to have people sitting around waiting for you to come up with the next verse or the bridge to a song than it is to just do it at your own pace and let the machines sit around and wait while you think.
You started doing this kind of solo production technique on comparatively primitive equipment. I'm thinking it's primitive recording technology compared to what's available now. You started doing this in the late 60s, early 70s. What were some of the technical challenges it provided for you and some of the artistic ones?
Well, in terms of playing the instrument, the greatest technical challenge is playing the instruments. It's not so much the sounds or the studio techniques, particularly if you're engineering it yourself. It probably looks a little comical. I should probably put a time-lapse camera in the studio sometime to see what it's like, especially when you have to do something like play the drums. And I got the drums set up downstairs, and my control room is up a flight of stairs. And every time I get through a take, I have to run upstairs to check it out. And if it's wrong, I have to come down and do it again. Or if I get halfway through, I have to run upstairs and rewind the tape. It gets a little bit slapstick at times. That's probably the greatest challenge. I've never been particularly cowed by the technical aspects of recording.
Do you think, in a way, that sampling, the new kind of synthesizer, has made studio production too easy, has made it too easy to do what you've been doing for so many years? Make a whole record with just one instrument?
That part was always relatively easy. The hard part is writing songs, and there aren't any machines to help you do that right now.
Do you enjoy concerts? I know you've done a lot of concerts with your bands as well as concerts as a solo performer. How do you enjoy concerts, or would you rather be alone in your studio without an audience watching?
I don't play as much probably as some people do. I get a couple of weeks in every year or every half a year. Right now I'm in the midst of what is for me a relatively long tour of about 2 months. So touring it's not that I don't like to play in front of people. It's just that I don't like to be away from my from what I consider to be my more creative environment, which is at home, where I can work on music and other projects and accomplish a lot more things. Being on the road, you only accomplish one thing a day, and that's playing a show.
Todd Rundgren is my guest. You mentioned your songs. Let's talk about your songwriting. Now, you were writing and recording a lot of pop songs in the late 60s and 70s when you started your career. And I'm thinking that that's a period where psychedelic music was considered the really hip music to be playing and listening to. And your music was, in a lot of ways, much more pop. And I wonder how that was received at the time, and if you were made to feel out of step with what was really hip and relevant.
I presume you're referring mostly to sort of the Nas days. Psychedelia was soon replaced by heavy metal and disco music, I guess, by the time we got into the early 70s. But yeah, the Nas was based on a nearly anti-psychedelic concept. I didn't particularly believe that you should make music that required a special circumstances to enjoy it, you know, that it had to transcend the circumstances. It's not that it was consciously pop, it's just that it was certainly devoid of a lot of that dependence on a certain lifestyle in order to make it successful.
You've written songs about a lot of different subjects, and you don't only write love songs. Love songs are usually the staple of lyrics. Has that been intentional? Do you want to have a wide variety of subjects in your songs?
Yes, it is intentional. I'm my own biggest fan. I like to listen to my own records, and therefore I don't like to be bored with them or think that there is some lackadaisical motivation behind them. I stopped writing those kind of songs many years ago because I realized that I wasn't writing that subject matter because it mattered to me so much, but because it was standard operating procedure for anybody who is making records. And I decided that in order to make myself feel like I was doing something worthwhile, I had to cover some ground that somebody else hadn't already trampled to death.
I want to play a record that you made called Onomatopoeia, and this was, I think, from an album in around 1978.
This is Hermit of Mink Hollow. Yeah, this is certainly your unusual lyric subject matter.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about producing this record? It's really a lot of fun.
Well, the
to
only...
listen to, anyways. I don't know if it was fun to produce.
It was fun, but it... of course, it utilized more conventional techniques than people have available nowadays. I suppose nowadays somebody might sample all the effects instead of actually doing them live. These most, for the most part, were either sung live along with, or expectorated live along with the rest of the music, or else they were put onto quarter-inch tape and edited and flown into the music.
And our listeners will hear the sound effects that you're referring to in a moment. My guest is Todd Rundgren, and this is his record, Onomatopoeia.
Every time I see ya, my senses tell me hub and I just can't disagree. I got a feeling in my heart that I can't describe. It's sort of lub, cub, lub, cub. A sound in my head that I can't describe. It's sort of zoom, zip, pick up, drip, ding, dong, crunch, crack, bark, meow, whinny, quack. In proximity, I rearrange my brain in a strange cacophony. I get a feeling somewhere that I can't describe. It's sort of a sound in my head that I can't describe. It's sort of whack, whir, wheeze, whine, sputter, flat, squirt, scrape, clink, clank, clunk, clatter, crash, bang, beep, buzz, ring, rip, roar, wretch, twang, toot, tingle, thud, pop, plop, clunk, snort, snuck, snip, smack, screech, splash, swish, squeak, jingle, rattle, squeal, boing, honk, boot, hack, belch.
Todd Rundgren doing his song Onomatopoeia. What's interesting, you know, you've been very popular for a long time. You've had a few hits, but you don't usually top the charts yourself. And I wonder if that would be important to you. It sounds like you're more interested in just independence and being able to write your own songs and produce them the way you want to, perform them the way you want to.
Yeah, more or less. I'm really happy that there's a Madonna, you know, who all the crazy people can pay attention to. So that I can I can make my music in peace. Thank you.
Your career is expanding beyond records, and I'd like to talk about some of the current projects that you're involved in. Now, one of the things that you're doing is writing music for the new series of Pee-wee's Playhouse shows, and you wrote music for several of the first round of programs. How did you get involved with writing music for Pee-wee's Playhouse?
When Pee-wee put together his show, he asked several of his musician friends, Danny Elfman and Mark Mothersbaugh and myself amongst them, if they would contribute music to the show. And we all consented and we all contributed music. I was just one of the, I think there were four composers involved. And over the course of the season, I did four episodes, I believe.
What kind of work do you typically have to do?
What
kind of work do you typically have to do? Do they send you the video without music or just a script?
You get a videotape with time code and no music on it. And at least as regards Pee-wee's show, there isn't even spotting notes. They just make a few suggestions about a part that they might think is especially weak and needs something, and then the rest of it is just totally up to me or whomever.
So they don't even tell you where they want music. You just decide where it goes.
Essentially, yes.
Did you watch a lot of kids' TV when you were young?
Let me see now. I used to watch Lunch with Soupy Sales. That was my favorite show when I was a kid.
Yeah, I still like that, too. But thinking if music from those shows ever stuck in your mind.
I don't recall that a lot of music from those shows stuck in my mind, no. Most of them were pretty crappy.
Right. Well, I want to play some of the music that you wrote. And for Pee-wee's Playhouse. And this segment that we're going to hear comes from the second episode of the first round of Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's the one where he wins dinner for two at a Hawaiian restaurant. And this is toward the beginning of the episode when he gets a call from a TV game show host, and he's got to answer the question that the game show host calls him with.
Question, you'll win a big prize. Are you ready? Why do cows have bells? The Kalani Lanai Hawaiian Restaurant. Thanks for playing, and I hope you had fun. Ah! I get it. Secret word.
Congratulations, Pee-wee.
What I really like about that segment that we just heard is you have these wonderful fractured takes on quiz show music, and what sounds to me like a fractured version of the Jeopardy theme, and your take on the inspirational Rocky theme after he wins the dinner for two.
Yes, it was a case history in plagiarism. Yeah, the kind of, you know, that a lot of times you, when you're doing that kind of thing, you can make something sound, even though the notes are all different, put it in the same kind of framework as a different piece of music and make people think of the other one, you know, without actually having literally stolen it.
Well, there are so many musical cliches that we all know from TV, and there's even ethnic musical cliches, like you have some really corny Hawaiian music that you use in there. I really like it when people know how to work with those cliches and subvert them and make them very funny.
Yeah, I'm a big subverter.
Todd Rundgren is my guest, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Todd Rundgren. He's a composer, musician, singer, and record producer who's now also writing music for television and Broadway. And he's on a tour now. He's speaking to us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. I know a lot of musicians feel very displaced by synthesizers because they think if it weren't for synthesizers, they'd be playing in orchestras or bands for TV and movie soundtracks. And I wonder what you think about that. You're probably one of the people who those musicians resent.
I think they're kidding themselves, myself. You know, the point is that the budget is the budget, and you use whatever you can afford in the budget. And people think that all of a sudden, you know, all these people use synthesizers on records, you know, to make string sounds and horn sounds, that their alternative would be they would hire all these musicians to make the string and horn sounds. That's wrong. They won't hire the musicians to make the string and horn sounds because they won't spend the money to do it. I enjoy using regular musicians and do often, but I certainly wouldn't, bust the bank just to use other musicians, for instance, to imitate some kind of a little bit of string slush or atmosphere, when you could just as easily do it with a keyboard.
You were commissioned by Joseph Papp, the theater impresario, to write a score for Up Against It, which is a musical that the late British playwright Joe Wharton was writing as a vehicle for the Beatles. I guess the Beatles were going to write songs that fit into this play, and Wharton died before the project was completed. How did you get into this project?
Well, Joe Wharton had this mini revival about a year or two ago with a couple of his plays becoming successful on Broadway. And so somebody in Joe Papp's office came up, his name is Tom Ross, but he came up with this property that Jordan had been preparing for the Beatles. And at first they wanted it to be kind of like pick up where they left off and have it be Beatlesque, but I suggested that people nowadays who live through it may have a certain nostalgia, but most people who didn't actually live through it don't really care to live through it or care to relive it. So it was better to just approach it as if it was a Broadway musical and not even worry about the Beatles connection.
So you're not writing music in the manner of the Beatles?
Absolutely not.
It's interesting because when one of your records, what you did was try to duplicate the sound of the Beatles, to do their records as if it were them. But
yeah, well, we got that out of our system.
Right.
It's one of those things you can only do once, and hopefully it won't become too big an albatross after doing it once. I suppose it was instrumental in getting me involved in this thing, because the original concept had something to do with Beatles music, and that was why they asked, was because of that that faux Beatles album. But I don't really want to do that more than once.
You said that you got it out of your system trying to do music that sounded exactly like the Beatles. When you were younger, were you influenced by each album that they did? Did your style start changing with each album that they brought out?
Well, I didn't start writing songs until after I stopped listening to the Beatles, which was sometime around Sgt. Pepper. I thought that Sgt. Pepper was a precipitous fall from the previous album. I thought it was kind of self-indulgent stuff. I enjoy listening to it now, but in a certain way, it took what was originally... it was kind of interesting. The Beatles were, at first, they were like... When they got to Revolver and they started making comments about how popular they were as compared to Jesus and things like that, I mean, I thought that was kind of a dopey thing to say, but their music, to me, justified it. And it also still belonged to, you know, instead of particularly, you know, like we as kids owned it in a certain respect. Then when they came out with Sgt. Pepper, it just kind of, to me, was they had sort of watered down everything so that to make it accessible. And even though there's supposed to be a lot of experimental aspects in there, when George Burns started covering the songs, I started to think, no, I'm not interested anymore.
George Burns started covering their songs?
You know, of course. He did a version of When I'm 64.
Oh,
you know,
of course,
everybody's,
of course.
You know, doing,
right.
Everybody's doing She's Leaving Home. You know, everybody's trying to see what Beatles songs they can cover. And, you know, and it's... then everybody started doing like sycophantically everything the Beatles did, you know, regardless of how ridiculous it was. Everybody wanted to get into transcendental meditation, and I thought it was just, at that point, it was over for me. You know, it was just too over the top.
You know, a question for a lot of people who play rock and roll is, does the music change and does your attitude toward it change as you get older, since we all used to think of rock and roll as teenage music? And I guess for you, part of that, the answer to that question is diversifying.
Well, it's partly that, and I think we're also bound to misunderstand the music that youth that youth gravitates towards. You know, I was just talking to Willie the other night, and he said he attended an Anthrax concert to see one of our old road crew doing the lights. And it makes you really feel old, you know. See, like, you know, see all the kids just like out there vomiting at each other, you know, playing music at 150 decibels, and you know, and slam dancing and stuff like that. And you say, "What the hell is the matter with these kids?" You know, in my day, we were wearing Edwardian suits and wore like styled our hair. You know, we figured that was what outraged our parents, and it seems tame by comparison, but. You know, I think we're just destined as we grow older to misunderstand these musical phases that are coming behind.
What was it like for you when you became a rock star when you were still really pretty young? Did you were you prepared for that amount of attention, and did you feel like you had enough charisma to to keep it up?
Well, I think I was cynical enough to deal with it, but I wasn't prepared for the reality of what the music business was like. It's not the fans' fault, you know, like if they do or don't buy your records, you know, it's never their obligation to buy your records. But the things that go on behind the scenes are pretty weird and sleazy. You know, you attract a lot of creepy people who have little to do with the actual creative part of making music.
Who are you referring to, people in the industry or strange fans who attend?
Mostly people in the industry side of it, you know, promoters, slugs from the union who come up, you know, trying to collect their, you know, their little dues and stuff like that, and all these people who just, you know, who are just like barnacles great big barnacles on what is supposed to be a creative industry.
How do you get free of it? Or do you?
Well, you don't get free of it. You don't you don't function in this industry unless you find a way to accommodate it one way or another. But I kind of like have straddled a certain area since I don't demand it. I don't demand anything from my record company that they make me a hit or anything like that. Then that means that there's less demands on me. And that's the way I prefer it.
A lot of your old records are being reissued now on CD by Rhino Records. Are you listening to them as they come out? Do you like to listen to your records?
I don't like to listen to the older ones. There's some I can handle, a little more recent, but the old ones are like baby pictures. You know, it's your butt hanging out.
Okay, Todd Rundgren, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
My guest has been composer, musician, and record producer Todd Rundgren. His earlier records on the Bearsville label have just been reissued by Rhino Records on compact disc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.